Nixon Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based Emerging Actors and Dance School of Drama and Music University students. Advance tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca.
This ain't Monkey Wrench by Foo Fighters. This isn't actually an ad for my new show. You want to join me, Zach, every Saturday at 8 p.m. for your favorite 90s hits, throwbacks, and deep cuts. We'll be playing you songs like this all night from 8 to 9 p.m. So join me as I take you to the 90s.
You're listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline. On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queen's. Tune in for Close Reads from close by. Today, we'll be doing something a little bit different. We'll be talking about the play Carter vs. Condoms by Henry Friedlander, which was just featured in the fall 2024 installment of the Dan Studio series, DSS Resilience. Henry Friedlander is in his fifth year of psychology and is so excited for Carter vs. Condoms to come to life. He would like to thank his mother, his father, brother, and pet goldfish. Henry would also like to give a very special thank you to the Dan Studio series for their purchase of hundreds of condoms. Here's the summary of Henry's play. When Carter's condom breaks during sex, he naturally decides to sue the condom company, much to his partner's dismay. However, after the condom company alleges the condom could only have broken if Carter had been using the wrong size, Carter must make an unthinkable choice. What is most important to a man? Money, or everyone thinking you have a big penis? We'll be talking to Henry about his play, but first, here's I Fought the Law by The Clash. I'm now here with Henry Friedlander, the writer of Carter vs. Condoms. Henry, I wanted to start by asking you about your inspiration and your writing process. Tell me about how you went about writing Carter vs. Condoms.
So it was the type of thing that like first started as a joke, sort of a story that I pitched to my friends on a walk home from class, just as like a silly idea. We laughed about it. I didn't think much of it. Just I thought it was such a funny concept of someone in the court of law having to show their penis to a judge and jury and being judged on the size of it and what was more important to sort of a male, a stereotypical man. Everyone thinking you have a big penis or hypothetically getting a lot of money. And so it was just a silly idea to start with until I took a playwriting class. It was my first time ever taking a playwriting class and really writing for the stage before. And I brought up the idea in the class. And the professor kind of laughed at it, the class kind of laughed at it, and I didn't really think much of it until towards the end of that class, the professor actually came up to me and she offered me $50 for my idea. And this was the first time anyone's offered me money for an idea, let alone sort of gave a vote of confidence to the idea. And I sort of thought about that and I thought, wow, if this professor, who is a playwright, she's written several plays in Toronto, if she is willing to offer me 50 whole dollars for this idea, then maybe it has some sort of value. And so I denied the $50 and I decided I'm going to write this idea of Carter v. Condoms. At the time it was called Connor v. Condoms. I'm going to write it into a short 20-minute stage production just to see how it would look if I fleshed it out. And it was April of that year. I went home in May and I started writing. And it began with sort of writing. The first thing I wrote was the scene in which the lawyer character asks Carter to see his penis. And that was the first thing I wrote. And from there, I sort of built around everything else. And I fleshed out the characters more. And that was only the first draft. And that was maybe 2 years before we put it, before it was made into an actual production. And since then, you know, it went through a lot of changes. You know, I showed it to my friends. I showed it to people who I thought were funny and to get their opinions on it. And it really sort of evolved, especially when, you know, we developed other characters such as Susie and Tanya, the Susie being Carter's girlfriend / situationship in the show, Tanya being the lawyer representing the condom company. And so as we fleshed things out, like, things started to sort of fall into place more. And it went from a very sort of abstract, silly idea into something a little more grounded, but also still absurd and sort of based in sort of the silliness of the of that initial question, which I pitched to my friends on that walk home, sort of, what would you do if you were in a court of law and you could either get a bunch of money or you could have everyone think your penis was really big?
Wow, that's a really interesting, like, sort of genesis of the idea, the way that, like, initially the prof is like, you know, that's ridiculous and sort of makes fun of it. But then afterwards, there's this very real valuation, like, literally in terms of, like, the monetary value of, like, this is a serious thing. And that's kind of funny in a way that, like, what made you realize that it was something that was worth writing was the fact that someone else thought they could write it. But, I mean, those of us that have seen the play know, like, no one else could have written this play. It just, like, the voice is just so absurd and funny. And it just has such a strong, like, originality to it. And so, you know, I'm glad you didn't take the $50 because that means we all got to see this really great play. My next question in this interview is, I want to ask a little bit about the Dance Studio Series, which is the production company that you produce this play in collaboration with. So the Dance Studio Series produces this alongside several other works. And DSS describes itself as a student-run theater collaborative. And for those who haven't heard of DSS before, that means that all levels of production are staffed by student volunteers, and that's from the production and creative teams all the way to the crew and actors. So I wanted to ask, how do you find the collaborative process of editing and producing this play? Maybe you know, like, alongside other people, but also alongside other plays.
Yeah, and that was one thing that I really loved about the Dance Studio Series, how collaborative it was, mm-hmm. how you work so closely with other students. I was lucky enough to work with two excellent directors, Kate and Serena, on this play, and from the get-go, it was a collaborative process with them. And then after we casted the show, it was a collaborative process with our actors as well. You know, I really valued their insights and sort of how they wanted sort of the script to go. If they had suggestions with dialogue, with scenes, with sort of their own vision, like, I wanted to make that a reality, because I think as a comedy, it's kind of hard to write in the sense of, like, what I find funny might not be exactly what others find funny. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice to hear from my actors and from the directors, like, what they thought was sort of funny and what they thought would be good for a scene. And almost every suggestion they had, like, I gave a thumbs up, because, you know, as a writer, you know, you create a piece and you give it into the world. And I had very little to do with the direction mm-hmm. and with sort of the actual production of the show. And so I really wanted them to sort of have their own take on it. And ultimately, like, when I enjoy seeing theater, I enjoy seeing the actors on the stage having the most fun they possibly can. I think mm-hmm. that energy on the stage is infectious, especially for a comedy. So I wanted, as long as the actors were having fun and the actors were also comfortable with what they're saying, I was all for it. So to collaborate on that and to have the actors sort of take a leadership role in their own dialogue was really, really cool. And I think that's sort of very unique to student theater, how collaborative it is. And also just DSS as a whole, you know, having other actors from other shows coming up to me and saying, oh, I read your script. I really liked it. And to see other shows as well and seeing that whole process was really, really special. And then ultimately, when you go and you see the production and you see sort of, you know, for example, in the audition process, you know, the shows, the actors who are auditioning, you know, would read a cold read of a show. And to see those cold reads even evolve from, you know, a month and a half prior to now was really, really cool. And ultimately just shows how collaborative the entire process is and how everyone's working together. You know, there's no one rule, there's no one method to make a show, especially in student theater, possible. And ultimately, when everyone works together, like how DSS does, it leads to, you know, incredible, incredible pieces.
We'll be right back after Too Little Too Late by the Bare Naked Ladies, and I'll be asking Henry more questions about this piece. If you're just tuning in, this is Close Reads. We're talking to Henry Friedlander, the writer of Carter vs. Condoms. I want to talk about something, not that Henry has said, but that he's kind of been doing. He has a very good radio voice, and that would be because he's actually an actor as well as a playwright. So Henry, I wanted to ask you if you can speak to maybe like the different experiences of writing versus performing in a theater production. Do you find that your experience is really different from being on stage, or are there sort of similarities between those different creative roles?
Yeah, I think it's very different in the sense of, you know, if you're an actor, you're on the stage, you're working with a script, you sort of are working within the confines of the production you're in, whether it's, you know, the director's vision or, you know, what the script allows. You know, you're sort of basing your performance off of a material. While writing, you have full creativity over, you know, you can write whatever you want, which is, you know, a really, really cool experience and something I was always drawn to. And I think in that sense, It was really cool to explore those differences and to write something that I would want to perform in. Mm-hmm. Like these characters, mainly the titular Carter and Hank, the lawyer, these were characters like I would want to play. And I sort of, when I was thinking about the characters and thinking about writing, I sort of brought it back to my experience as an actor. You know, I've been in theater productions in high school and my time at Queens now. I was really involved in theater, and so I really used my experiences there to sort of base my interpretation of these characters and sort of what I thought would be entertaining for an audience, especially doing a lot of productions where I sort of played comedic characters. Mm-hmm. And I played sort of the comedic relief. And so I really tapped into those experiences to create context for these characters and sort of the dialogue they had. And it was really nice to sort of go back into the theater, because for the last about year, I've sort of taken a break from traditional sort of stage productions in theater. So mm-hmm. To now work with the Dan Studio series and to write this and to bring it to life, it was really nice to sort of go back into that world and sort of create a new appreciation I had for it. And to sort of create something, make it, bring it out into the world, give it to trust other people to bring it to life, and then to sort of come back and see it happen is really, really unique and very different from being an actor. You know, when you're an actor, you see the whole process. You know, you see it go from sort of rough outlines and workshopping. You see it develop. You see, you know, the other actors, you know, get sharper and you know, you see the whole process from start to finish. While this was a little more different. It was a little more about not really seeing that whole process, and instead seeing, you know, the script become the production, which was sort of unique to see, and it made me a little reminiscent of my time in the theater and mm-hmm. seeing sort of seeing that process, and it was really cool to see.
I want to touch on something that you said a little bit earlier about sort of coming from like a comedic actor background. Do you find that in these roles you've been sort of like a comedic character within a dramatic piece, or like working in comedies as the genre?
I think it's been a bit of a mix. I'd say throughout my time doing theater, I've done quite a few like comedy-based shows, playing like sort of funny characters, and a few times playing a comedic relief in a more dramatic setting. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of different depending on the show. And even a few times I've played a dramatic character in a production or two, which, you know, I found as an actor, as someone who's traditionally only ever done like comedic roles and feels the most comfortable doing comedic roles, I kind of was like, I don't know if this is for me, playing more dramatic roles. But, you know, and I think that's an excellent sort of thought about, you know, I think there is a difference between like sort of a comedic character in a dramatic role and a comedic character in a comedic show. Mm-hmm. And I think for Carter V. Condoms, you know, there is drama. There is sort of, you know, conflict between characters. And there is sort of at times real sort of emotional moments. But I think ultimately my experiences doing shows where I was more of a comedic character in a dramatic piece sort of brought some of that more dramatic elements to Carter V. Condoms, especially for the character of Susie, who kind of plays the straight man to Carter's sort of foil. Mm-hmm. You know, that was sort of their dynamic. And so for Susie particularly, you know, to tap into those dramatic moments, you know, my sort of experience in more dramatic pieces of theater sort of helped me with that character.
Yeah, I did notice, like, watching it, like, Susie is kind of living in a bit of a different genre than Carter's living in, and that does cause a lot of sort of the conflict between them, where they're really having different conversations, and it does, you know, it goes on in a kind of comedic way, and it is funny to see that, but it's interesting that kind of clash between genres is present there. And also the character of Tanya, I guess, the rival lawyer, she's very funny, but she also is a bit of a straight man, and she's being very serious about all of this, you know, like, this penis law stuff, and really the other characters are just not taking it that seriously. Or, you know, they're trying to, but because of the sort of genre, they're not. And I want to segue actually right back into my next question, because it is also about comedy. And the fact that Carter vs. Condoms is a comedy, and we haven't really talked about comedy as a genre yet at all on Close Reads. And it's also the only, as you said, it's like the only like full comedy that was included in DSS Resilience. Of course, there are comedic moments and other pieces, but it's the only one that really is like dedicated to that as a genre, which I thought was kind of an interesting experience when watching it. So I wanted to ask, like, what draws you to comedy as a writer, or maybe as a theater artist more broadly? You've talked about your acting experience as well. And I also wanted to ask, do you think that the value of comedy is overlooked in the arts?
For sure. I would say I was first drawn to comedy in artistic performance because that was what I found the most fun. I started doing mm-hmm. theater because I had a lot of fun performing. And I had a lot of fun, you know, just doing silly things on stage. And honestly, from there, I sort of became more attracted to the dramatic side of performance as I got older. And I just think it's a lot of fun to write comedy. It's a lot of fun to see comedy. It's a lot of fun to sort of participate in that and be part of that world. And I do think the value of comedy is sort of overlooked in the arts. I think it's at times it can be difficult to write comedy, mm-hmm. Just because it's so varied what some people might find funny and what others might find funny. And, you know, I didn't know if people would find this play funny when I first wrote it. Like, I thought there was a chance, you know, it would miss, because sometimes, you know, what I find funny is very different from what others find funny. But I also think that comedy is overlooked in the sense, like, you can still bring across powerful messages and powerful themes through comedy, sometimes even more dramatically than in dramatic pieces. You know, Carter V. Condoms looks at themes of masculinity. It looks mm-hmm. at themes of, you know, sex and relationships in sort of. And it's, you know, it could have been a dramatic piece. And I sort of am now thinking, like, I wonder what Carter V. Condoms would look like if it was just purely dramatic, you know, if it was a dark court drama. And I think comedy can oftentimes bring across these themes in ways that are different from sort of dramatic pieces. And I think artists and writers should challenge themselves more to write in comedy. Just as even as an exercise, because I think it's really valuable in terms of thinking about, you know, what does an audience want and what does an audience look for in a performance? Because ultimately, when you're writing comedy, the first thought I always have is, sure, I find this funny, but would an audience find it funny? Would this work for an audience of, in this case of the Dance Studio series, university students mainly? And so that was what I was thinking when I was writing it. You know, what would work for an audience? What would be funny for an audience? And what would be funny for the performers? You know, if the performers don't enjoy what they're doing, if they don't think they're funny, then they're not going to, you know, they're not going to let their comedic instincts sort of take hold and sort of allow them to sort of bring out what needs to be brought out for this particular piece.
So next we're going to play Lawyers, Guns, and Money by Warren Zevon. There are no guns in Carter versus Condoms, but there are lawyers and money, so I thought it was a pretty apt choice. And after that, we'll come back to this interview. If you're just tuning in, I'm here with Henry Friedlander, the writer of Carter versus Condoms, and you're listening to Close Reads. I just want to wrap up this interview by asking a bit more of a close reading question. We normally do, you know, quite a bit of close reading on this show. That's why it's called what it is. But I was really thinking about, you know, this piece as a play and this piece as a comedy. And I was thinking, like, the reason why we close read and why I like to close read is to, I guess, add depth to the piece, to open up more opportunities. And I think that for a genre like comedy, I think that, you know, this idea that explaining the joke really doesn't make it funny anymore. And I think that if we were, like, overanalyzing, like, this is funny for this reason, I think it would kind of, it would kill the piece more than elevate it. And that's not, you know, what we want to do in this show. So we're not doing close reading formally, but I wanted to do a bit of close reading with you, Henry. Your play's a comedy, and it's quite absurd at times, as we've discussed. But at the same time, it's very much grounded in the relationships between the characters. And because of the play form, it's through the interactions and the dialogue between those characters that we really get a sense of who the characters are. Can you talk to me a bit about the characters and their relationships with each other? And also, I wanted to ask if you conceive of the play as maybe the characters determining the plot or the plot shaping the characters.
Yeah. First, I guess it's when thinking about the characters and their relationships, it's sort of interesting. I think about them in terms of like duos. There was Carter and Susie. Obviously, they have their relationship that leads to the condom breaking. And then there's Hank and Tanya, like the two lawyers. Tanya representing the condom company, Hank representing Carter. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting in the sense that though Carter meets all the three other characters, the other characters don't meet sort of their other counterpart. For like Hank never meets Susie. Susie will never meet Tanya. Mm-hmm. Tanya never meets Susie and so on and so forth. And so when thinking about like their relationships, you know, those duos almost act as a foil and as a straight man sort of together. Carter is Susie's sort of foil, and Hank is Tanya's foil in terms of comedy. And then what's interesting is then when there's a few scenes where it's Hank and Susie, Hank and Carter together, Carter often acts as Hank's foil. Or Carter acts as Hank's straight man, and Hank is the foil. And so one thing, when I was thinking about the relationships, it's sort of hard for two characters to sort of both be the comedic relief or the comedic point in a scene. You need to have a character to balance out the main comedic character in mm-hmm. a given scene. And so, especially writing in the Dance Duo series, plays are only about 20 to 25 minutes long. So, you know, there weren't much opportunities to explore the comedy from other characters. Though I thought, like, you know, what would a scene look like between Susie and Hank? You know, how would that sort of go? And then in terms of their actual relationships with each other, you know, Susie and Carter are, university-aged characters. So much like I'm sure a lot of the listeners to this, and I'm sure a lot of the people who saw the Dance Studio series. And so I think their relationship of sort of that classic situationship, you know, friends with benefits who aren't, you know, friends who could be more than friends, and, you know, they're sort of in between that friendship and relationship sort of paradigm, you know, that leads to sort of tension and conflict, in which I'm sure a lot of the people who watched the Dance Studio series could sort of relate to. And then in terms of, you know, the characters determine the plot, or does the plot shape the characters? I really do think the plot is sort of what shapes the characters. You know, these characters are put in a situation, and it's their decisions about this situation that sort of drive the plot forward. You know, Carter decides to sue the condom company after the condom breaks, and then Susie and all the other characters get dragged into that. And it's actually interesting in the sense of, like, maybe for Carter, and, you know, he's the one who started this lawsuit. He's the one who's met Hank and who's met Tanya and who's done all this action to sort of sue the condom company. He is sort of being shaped by the plot. While Susie, I would say, maybe is determining the plot a little bit more, because Susie, as a character, doesn't care about the lawsuit. What she wants is Carter to be dedicated towards her in order to help her with the child that's on the way, as the condom did break, resulting in Susie getting pregnant. So for Susie, you know, she is determining the plot, I would say, more so than Carter. You know, she is trying to get Carter to do something independent of the plot, while the main crux of the story being the condom breaking is more of Carter's problem. Like, that's sort of what Carter is preoccupied with, while Susie particularly is more occupied with something completely separate, which sort of adds to the comedy. Sort of the final scene in the play is Susie finally explaining to Carter that she never really cared about the lawsuit, and that it was more about Carter wanting to use his attention and energy towards a lawsuit rather than helping out Susie. And sort of that sort of difference between, you know, is it the character determining the plot? Is the plot shaping the characters? That sort of difference between Susie and Carter is what sort of leads to that tension and that and at times comedy between the two characters.
Henry, thank you so much for all of your answers. Thank you for coming in and for sharing your piece with us. And, you know, thank you so much for all of this. This was really fantastic. Carter vs. Condoms was produced by the Dance Studio Series in their fall 2024 installment, DSS Resilience. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. I feel so incredibly fortunate to be able to bring all of these amazing artistic minds to you on Close Reads. And if you enjoy our show, we'd like to ask that you donate to the CFRC's annual funding drive. We have run numerous community arts programs, including Shortwave Radio Theater Camp for kids in the summer, our seasonal beginner-level DJ workshops, and our new Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence program featuring live performances by local emerging artists throughout the next year. Your support helps us continue to provide opportunities to local young and emerging artists to grow and connect with new audiences. Please donate today via cfrc.ca. Donations help run accessible opportunities for community members to participate in artistic programming at the station and also enjoy entertaining activities with their friends and family as they tune in and listen to amazing community member-created theater and music on our station. Visit cfrc.ca today and give to Queens now to get a tax receipt for your donation to CFRC through Queens University. Or donate securely through our website and get amazing free CFRC gifts and chances to win raffle prizes from local businesses. For every $5 donated, you get one raffle ticket and lots of CFRC swag.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit cfrc.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at cfrc.ca. Thank you for your support.
Hey everyone, this is Joseph Guido. I am CFRC's Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence Project Intern. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern, top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via cfrc.ca.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, donors also earn one more ticket for each of our weekly raffle draws, featuring prizes from wonderful local businesses, including Agent 99, Allure Hair Extension Room, Atomica, Black Dog Tavern, Brian's Record Option, Cheremare Spa, Diane's Fish Shack and Smokehouse, Gray Mulkin's Wireworks, and Minotaur Games and Gifts. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat. Beat.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Beat. Join us every Thursdays at 1 on
CFRC
for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.
And you're listening to The Only Show.
Beat Banter.
On CFRC Radio.
Beat.
Andrew. It was about joy, it was about looking forward, it was about laughter, and it totally underestimated the fear and anger on the other side.
I hope this win sends a message to young people across the country that our democracy is big enough for them too.
I serve the people of this district first and foremost, but then also we have to be sustainable for that next generation.
To everyone who is watching, do not despair.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Macias. Mali's military junta moves against gay sex, a legal attack on Connecticut's trans athletes resumes, and mourning and making do after disappointing U.S. elections. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Montague.
And I'm Joe Bainline.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 9th, 2024. Mali's ruling military junta is moving to criminalize private consensual adult gay sex. Only one member of the National Transitional Council voted against sending the legislation on to President Assimi Goïta for his approval. The junta's Justice and Human Rights Minister, Mamadou Kasso, issued this warning after the October 31st vote. There are provisions in our laws that prohibit homosexuality in Mali. Anyone engaging in this practice, promoting or apologizing for it, will be prosecuted. We will not accept that our customs and values are violated by people from elsewhere. This text will be applied, God willing. Mali is a socially conservative, predominantly Muslim West African nation, where Islamic law condemns same-gender sex. The junta has been in power since a coup in 2020. Most Malayan Muslims think of gay sex as a Western import. Activist Naginda Naganga slammed that notion, saying LGBTQ plus people have always existed and they always will. She told the Washington Blade, "It's a human rights issue, and honestly, I have never understood why some are so concerned about others' personal choices and private lives. It's strange." To African rights activist Eugene Joko, the new law is only a distraction. He told The Blade, according to the minister, anyone who practices, promotes, or glorifies homosexuality will be prosecuted. However, restraining personal liberties is not how you will fix the country's problems. The full text of the same-gender sex ban has not been made public, but it is believed to apply only to men. There has been no hint what the penalty for violating the law might be.
A lawsuit challenging Connecticut's transgender-supportive statutes for school sports will go forward again. U.S. District Court Judge Robert N. Chitigny had initially dismissed the lawsuit after deciding that the plaintiffs did not have legal standing because they were no longer competing in high school sports. The second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed and sent the case back to him. Chitigny bent to the appeals court's opinion on November 5th. The plaintiffs are four cisgender female former high school track and field athletes. They claim that they lost college scholarships and other perks because they had to compete against two transgender female sprinters from 2017 through 2019. They're suing the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference and five local school boards for unspecified monetary damages. The suit also demands the removal of awards and records of any transgender athletes and re-ranking the results wherever they competed. Finally, the lawsuit demands revocation of the state policy, allowing trans athletes to compete in sports based on their gender identity. Judge Chitigny's 55-page decision noted that there is little guidance on how U.S. courts should deal with the issue of transgender athletes. Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 bans discrimination based on sex in any federally funded school program. However, there's no legal consensus about whether sex is the same thing as gender, and protections for trans people rests on that semantic distinction. Chitigny wrote, "This case presents a direct conflict between two interests protected by Title IX, the interest in providing fair competition for biological females, which has long been recognized as a significant governmental interest under Title IX, and the interest in providing transgender girls with opportunities to participate in girls' sports, which is now protected by a Connecticut state statute." The battle lines have been drawn. On the plaintiff's side is the rabidly anti-queer alliance Defending Freedom. Defending the pro-trans policy are the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation and the ACLU Foundation of Connecticut.
Global plane maker Boeing is crashing its diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Vice President Sarah Ling Bowen is gone, and the rest of her DEI department staff will be integrated into existing human resource teams charged with improving talent and employee experience. Bowen's farewell post on LinkedIn read in part, "It has been the privilege of my lifetime to lead equity, diversity, and inclusion at the Boeing Company these past 5+ years. Our team strived every day to support the evolving brilliance and creativity of our workforce. The team achieved so much, sometimes imperfectly, never easily, and dreamed of doing much more still. All of it has been worth it." With Boeing's decision, far-right social media maven Robbie Starbuck is claiming credit for another U.S. conglomerate abandoning its efforts to promote equitable, diverse, and inclusive workplace environments. Starbuck says that he warned Boeing board chair Steve Mollenkopf weeks ago that he was planning, in his words, to expose their woke policies. Those woke policies had included efforts to recruit employees from a variety of minority groups under former CEO Dave Calhoun. He stepped down in early August due to the corporation's financial troubles. Incoming CEO Kelly Ortberg has vowed to trim staff across the board by at least 10%. Meanwhile, a self-satisfied anti-woke Starbuck declares, "The landscape of corporate America is quickly shifting to sanity and neutrality."
Controversial trans woman dart star Noah Lynn Van Leeuwen is facing three-time champion Michael Van Gerwen as the first round of the Grand Slam of Darts gets underway. She and 20-year-old star Bo Greaves are the only two women in the draw. For Van Leeuwen, the Grand Slam is an arduous warm-up for the Professional Darts Corporation World Championship coming up at North London's Alexandra Palace in December. Van Leeuwen will be the first trans competitor to appear against men in a televised PDC tournament being covered live by Sky Sports. PDC chief executive Matthew Porter has staunchly defended her right to compete. He told Sky News, "Noah Lynn's started to achieve more success in recent years, hence the opposition to her has become more vocal, which is the way of the world. Again, it's something we respect, but ultimately we have a policy in place, and it's one that we're comfortable with." To Van Leeuwen, "There's really no difference between men and women in darts." If she defeats Van Gerwen in the first round, Van Leeuwen will face former world number one Gary Anderson and qualifier Ryan Joyce. Knockout rounds for the event, now in progress, start on November 13th. The Grand Slam concludes on November 17th.
Finally, the MUBI streaming service is canceling its international film festival in Istanbul. Organizers said in a Turkish-language Instagram statement that the district governorship of Istanbul was upset by the provocative content of the opening film, Queer. The much-ballyhooed adaptation of the second novel by famed queer writer William S. Burroughs features several steamy and explicit gay sex scenes with Daniel James Bond Craig, Drew Starkey, and Omar Apollo. The Turkish government banned the film on the grounds that it endangers the peace of society. MUBI responded by cancelling the entire festival because it said the ban targeted the very essence and purpose of the event. In the words of the global streaming platform, production company and film distributor, "We believe this ban is an intervention that restricts art and freedom of expression. Festivals are breathtaking spaces where art and cultural diversity are celebrated, bringing people together. This ban takes not just one movie away from the meaning and purpose of the entire festival." MUBI went on to thank all artists, viewers and supporters who were planning to attend the festival and who we believe are as saddened by this situation as we are for their understanding and solidarity. MUBI is available in over 190 countries on the web and publishes Notebook, a film criticism and news publication. Queer received a 9-minute standing ovation when it premiered at the Venice Film Festival earlier this year. It will hit cinema screens in the US on November 27th and on December 13th in the UK.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending November 9th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm Sarah Montague. Stay safe. Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
The result of the November 5th U.S. elections was a wake-up call for the so-called woke. President-elect Donald Trump's victory in both the Electoral College and the popular vote will be taken as a mandate for the most anti-progressive promises of his campaign. Pundits and activists foresee a repeat Trump administration, free to implement the far-right's Project 2025 vision for the country. A vision that at worst includes mass deportations, the quashing of civil liberties, and potential economic chaos. Yet even though the overall election results spell danger, there are a number of queer bright spots we can report. First, the bad news from our friends Andy Hum and Ann Northrop of Gay USA.
What can you say except that the Trump victory was a victory for misogyny, racism, anti-LGBTQ prejudice, especially transphobia, xenophobia, isolationism, and despoilation of the environment, among other things?
Well, those are certainly the consequences of the victory, but I think the core of the victory was fear and anger, as Claire McCaskill said.
First, I think we have to acknowledge that Donald Trump knows our country better than we do.
Former U.S. Senator and MSNBC political analyst Claire McCaskill.
I think he figured out that anger and, frankly, fear were way more powerful than appealing to people's better angels. Whether you're afraid of immigrants or afraid of people who are trans, he figured that out.
The thing that struck me the day after the election is we all sort of got sucked in by the joy of the Harris campaign. It was the greatest presidential campaign ever run.
It was decent.
And it totally underestimated
right.
the fear and anger on the other side, particularly the anger.
Now, I'm not trying to rationalize it or sugarcoat it, but obviously this happens around the world. When people are unhappy, they vote for the other, and it's generally the other guy.
It just reeks of misogyny and racism. I think it was a real, it's always a wake-up call, but we really believed that she had a very good chance of taking this, and,
yes,
and that we would take the Senate, and we would take the House, and we would do this and that and the other, because we thought the politics of joy and forward-looking would be the answer. But these people who went the other way, they weren't buying it.
Progressives dodged a political bullet on Election Day when North Carolina voters soundly rejected the GOP's far-right nominee for governor, Mark Robinson, whose term as the state's lieutenant governor runs out in January. I'm David Hunt. Robinson had hoped that an endorsement by Donald Trump, backed up by his own Trump-like rhetoric, would carry him to victory in the southern swing state. The sound bites came fast and furious.
There's no reason anybody anywhere in America should be telling any child about transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. And yes, I called it filth.
We are called to, here, getting ready to get in trouble, called to be led by men.
The Christian patriots of this nation will own this nation and rule this nation.
He said trans people should find a corner outside somewhere to use the bathroom, and called gender studies courses lies from the pit of hell. On Election Day, Democrat Josh Stein, North Carolina's attorney general, won the race handily, garnering more than 3 million votes, nearly 55%. Just 40% of voters marked their ballots for Robinson. Whatever the reason, progressives are happy to take the win, hoping the incoming Democratic governor will provide a check on the GOP-dominated legislature that remains hostile to the LGBTQ community. Reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina, for This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
I will say that the LGBTQ vote, NBC News exit poll, Harris led Trump 86-12 among LGBT voters, a 15% improvement on Biden's 2020 performance, although that figure was contested. 8% identified as LGBT, a record high. But again, Republicans spent $215 million on anti-trans ads to win.
All running football
games.
Which
is a horror. Whatever effect it had, it certainly had a horrible effect on trans people.
And I think it's more upsetting and destructive than just anti-gay ads. I think the trans issue at this point is still deeply upsetting to a great many people. We have not succeeded in educating them or inuring them to this.
But let's talk about the consequences of these Republican advances. The loss of the federal courts for the rest of our lives,
yes,
and probably yours. The end of the federal prosecutions of Trump, although he's still going to be sentenced in the November 26 New York State case. The filibuster, which we've hated, becomes of some value to Democrats.
All right, so we don't want them to get rid of it.
Not
right
now. And then anti-LGBTQ amendments. Now, the House has been passing those all along and have been stopped by the Senate, and maybe the filibuster can still stop some of those things. But and, of course, you're going to have this tremendous growth of the kleptocracy and the corruption.
There was some worry that trans voters would have trouble voting because of new, stricter,
yes,
ID laws across the country in various states.
Yes.
No reports yet on any of that happening.
I am happy I live in the state today because I woke up feeling like myself and my partner are safe. And I think that's true no matter what happens nationally.
Bruce Parker of Rocky Mountain Equality lives in Colorado, one of the three states whose voters repealed antiquated marriage equality bans. Such so-called sleeper laws could come back into force should the right-leaning Supreme Court overturn federal protections. This Way Out's Ava Davis, Michael Taylor Gray, and Melanie Keller have the details.
Question one in Hawaii asked, shall the state constitution be amended to repeal the legislature's authority to reserve marriage to opposite-sex couples? Honolulu's Star Advertiser reports that 52% voted yes.
In Colorado, voters approved Measure J with more than 63%, according to Colorado Public Radio. It removed language in the state constitution that declared, only a union of one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as a marriage in this state.
And in California, while the final votes are still being counted, Proposition 3 is projected to pass by at least a 60% margin. It removes language in the state constitution defining civil marriage as only between men and women.
Should we talk about what happened with some of the key LGBTQ races?
Yes, because we have good news there. And really, the idea that out trans Sarah McBride, a state senator from Delaware, close to the Biden family, is now going to the U.S. House of Representatives as Delaware's one member of the House is just so delicious.
I know how much this win would have meant to me as a young person, as I faced a crisis of hope and wondered whether the heart of this nation was big enough to love me too.
U.S. Congressmember-elect Sarah McBride.
And I hope this win sends a message to young people across the country that our democracy is big enough for them too. That regardless of the results at the top of the ticket, we all have a place in our country. We all belong. And I hope it shows that nothing is truly impossible.
And Julie Johnson, a Texas state representative, the first openly LGBTQ member of the U.S. Congress from the South. And your pal, our pal, Tammy Baldwin, it looks like held on in Wisconsin.
That was a squeaker.
Three-term Senator Tammy Baldwin.
I travel to red, blue, purple, rural, suburban, urban parts of our state. I listen to people. I really listen to people and then deliver for them. And in turn, these Wisconsinites showed up for me. And I'm so grateful.
Amy Wichtendahl has made history as the first out trans person elected to the Iowa legislature. She was already a member of the Hiawatha City Council. And Representative Angie Craig remains the first and only out LGBTQ member of Congress from Minnesota.
Obviously, I'm thankful for my supporters out there.
Congressmember Angie Craig.
But I'm really humbled by the voters of the 2nd District, my constituents, who recognize that I've been working on their behalf to do what is right for the 2nd District of Minnesota. And that's my commitment to them, is I will keep doing that. I'll work with anybody to tackle the issues that we have in our community, and that's what I intend to continue to do.
And Lisa Grafstein remains the only out LGBTQ member of the North Carolina Senate. Representative Sharice Davids has won re-election in Kansas. She remains the only openly LGBTQ Native American in Congress.
We're facing attempts to undermine our democracy, attempts that seek to sow division, confusion, and doubt in our democratic process. But here's the thing. We are better than that. Our state is better than that, and our country is better than that. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to continue to do this work for you all. Let's keep it going.
And State Representative Zoe Zephyr in Montana, who had a huge fight with the legislature, got kicked out.
Silenced.
For saying that they had blood on their hands.
Yes.
Got reelected. A new state senator in Georgia.
No.
Say his name. Rashawn Kemp, first gay black male in Georgia to join the legislature. And Eric Sorensen, out member of the House of Representatives, is likely reelected from Illinois.
It's about coming together to do what's best for all of us. And I'm so proud to be the good neighbor to represent you in the 119th Congress of the United States of America.
I still have a lot of faith in what is in front of us as this country.
Congressmember Eric Sorensen spoke with WQAD-TV after his victory rally.
And I'm going to do my part. I don't believe it should matter how you voted last night to determine what you deserve to get from your government going forward. Understanding that I serve the people of this district first and foremost, but then also we have to be sustainable for that next generation.
A woman's right to control her own body was on the ballot in 10 U.S. states. Voters approved measures to permanently enshrine that right in 7 of them: Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Missouri, Montana, Nevada, and New York. New Yorkers went even further with passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. It added age, ethnicity, national origin, disability, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, pregnancy, and pregnancy outcomes to state anti-discrimination laws. Voters in Nebraska and South Dakota broke with the until now 100% passage of protections when the issue has been on a state ballot in the past several months, even in deep red states like Ohio. The Florida initiative required 60% for passage, but it fell short with a bit under 58%. Deputy Director of Rocky Mountain Equality, Bruce Parker, spoke to KGNU in Denver, Boulder, Longmont, Colorado, about the relationship between abortion rights and queer rights.
You know, we got a lot of questions about why we endorsed 79, and people asked, you know, what does abortion have to do with LGBT people? And I think it's just clear that abortion is an LGBT issue, just like racism and just like maternal mortality and just like poverty and just about every other issue. We know that when communities are underserved and underrepresented and targeted by hate, they are affected more by these social issues and realities.
I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Former U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill expressed more than mere political analysis in her job at MSNBC.
I'm so proud. I'm so proud of her. As a woman, getting elected DA, it's not easy, guys. And then to be vice president and to step into the most difficult situation in the world where she had to be completely loyal to Joe Biden. I mean, such political skill. It is just inspiring. People who don't understand what she had to do to get to this moment. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just very proud of her.
To everyone who is watching, do not despair.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris conceded the election in a speech at historically black Howard University.
This is not a time to throw up our hands. This is a time to roll up our sleeves. This is a time to organize, to mobilize, and to stay engaged for the sake of freedom and justice and the future that we all know we can build together. And I'll close with this. There's an adage an historian once called a law of history, true of every society across the ages. The adage is, only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case. But here's the thing, America, if it is, let us fill the sky with the light of a brilliant, brilliant billion of stars. The light of optimism, of faith, of truth, and service. And may that work guide us, even in the face of setbacks, toward the extraordinary promise of the United States of America. I thank you all. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. I thank you all.
And so the hope and cheers of the Harris-Walz campaign are fading into history. Will those once joyful crowds throw up their hands, or will they roll up their sleeves? Will they keep proclaiming the campaign's theme song?
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Sarah Montague and Joe Bainline and produced by Brian DeShazer. This week's U.S. elections coverage was produced by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, with special thanks to Andy Hum and Ann Northrop at Gay USA TV. and to David Hunt, Ava Davis, Michael Taylor Gray, Melanie Keller, and Brian DeShazer. The Beatles and Beyoncé performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Daniel Macias. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WHYR, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, CJLY, Sloan Valley, New Denver, Nelson, Crawford Bay, British Columbia, KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music.